Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their very fast approaching Writers Conference, is going to be July 25th, I think it begins this July in the SeaTac here in Washington State. Don't miss it if you're a writer and you live here. It's still time to sign up. Anyway, to learn more about the PNWA and their Writers Conference, go to pnwa.org. You know, if you are a human being, which I know all of you are, whether you know it or not, or whether you want to admit it or not, you live in your imagination. You live in the human imagination, because right now, at this moment, as you listen to this show, you are listening on a computer that was imagined and then created by a human being, and you are probably sitting in a room built and imagined and built by human beings, wearing clothes imagined and created by human beings. Really, the whole human experience was imagined and then created by human beings. It's what we do. We live in that which we imagine and create. Hard to believe, but it's true. And one of the reasons I love writers of fantastic literature, like today's guest, the delightful Danica Dinsmore, is that they fully embrace this reality in one way or another. They create their own worlds, and that's certainly true of Danica. Not only has she created a world for her Fairy Tales from the White Forest series, of course, where she can put her fairy tales, but she is also a teacher of world building and world creation for writers of all ages. And so let's get her on the show and talk about worlds both real and imagined. Danica, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
It is my
pleasure. I really like your introduction, because it really is creating a life around the writing. It's not really separate.
You mean the difference between your life and your writing life?
It doesn't feel separate at all. It's not like here's my writing and here's my life. It's all together.
Not at all. I think not at all. I think that, you know, it's my motto that what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. But I don't know about you, but what I learn in creating the kind of essays or stories that I most want to tell has helped me create the kind of life I want to create. I use the same process. I don't know if you do, but I certainly do.
Yeah, I have to think about that. But I think so.
I live
my imagination all the time. I've also heard the phrase, how you do one thing is how you do everything. So,
yeah.
The commitment that you have to have the writing life, it really is a commitment, and it really is creating. I had to learn, for instance, how to be a lot more disciplined. And when I became more disciplined in my writing, I became more disciplined in other areas of my life as well.
Right, because you had a story probably about what it meant to be disciplined, that somehow it was the end of fun or the end of freedom. Right? Because you're a free spirit. I can hear that in your voice. And you had discipline is this mean, boring, drudgery kind of thing, right? Am I near
it felt
there?
Like the opposite of what I was. Yeah, yeah.
But discipline is commitment.
Yeah, I'm my own boss right now, right?
Yeah. How do you like that? Are you a good boss?
I love it, and it took a while to get there, and I fall out of it, I can't get down on myself when I fall out of my discipline or fall out of my routine. I just have to kind of pick up where I am, and you know, because life happens, you know.
Yeah.
We get thrown off track in many ways.
Yeah. Do you go through the thing, because writers, I think, often are challenged by their friends and family who, although acknowledge this is how you make your living, because you're not marching yourself off to an office somewhere or whatever, they feel at liberty to intrude upon your life, because you're just home writing. You can stop doing it whenever you want to. Do you have to shut the door on the rest of the world, even the people you love?
I do, and I'm actually really fortunate because I literally converted, we had an exterior garage to our house, and I converted that to my, I call it my cottage, or my den of destiny. It says den of destiny on the door right now. And so I literally, you know, I go out the door and I go to my cottage, and I think I'm really, really fortunate and grateful for that, because it must be really challenging to work inside of house when there's other people around. And yeah, they do feel like, so my husband knows when I'm out there, I'm doing my thing, and my friends know not to call me before a certain time every morning. That's, you know, I've established this is my writing time. I will not answer the phone if you call me before, you know, 11 o'clock or something.
Danica, do you know that I'm talking to you right now from my converted garage, which is my own little den?
Oh, no.
Yes, indeed, it's true. We bought this house because we said we can convert that two-car garage into a big workplace for my wife and me. Yeah, it's great.
There's
you close the door and take an office.
There's something about stepping out of the house and into this space, and to me it's a very magical space, and like you were talking about, you know, living in the imaginary world, my office is filled with, you know, visuals from my imaginary world and stuff that kids have drawn for me, so I feel like I'm in this totally separate magical space where the rest of the world drops away, and I know not everybody has that, but if they can create that in some way, shape, or form, you know, they should do it.
So do you do the thing where you, do you work from, who was I? Oh, I was talking to, that's right, Megan Chance. I was reading a blog. She writes a blog for Author Magazine, Megan Chance, and she writes historical fiction, but she likes, I didn't know this until I read her blog, but she uses characters from movies as the sort of like avatars, I guess, maybe that's not the right word, but when she's looking, when to create a character, she'll take a character or an actor from a movie or whatever and use that to write that person as a visual in their head. Do you have visuals up around you that you, when you want to think about forest or think about, you know, a babbling brook or whatever visuals you need to create your world, do you pull images from the internet or magazines as kind of inspiration, or is it all just up in your noodle?
It's up in my noodle. Yeah. I've never done anything like that before. I think I have a background in poetry and screenwriting before I became a novelist. In poetry, definitely, I was always, everything was very imagistic for me. I always wanted to have that no ideas but in things. But definitely for screenwriting, I was always imagining what was going to be on the screen, and that's how I wrote. I called it the movie screen of my mind. What am I seeing? And this is what I'm writing. And you have to do that as a screenwriter, because that's how the story is going to be told,
right,
visually. So
right.
I think that was just built in and drilled into. I actually don't know which came first. If I had that natural inclination,
uh-huh,
or if I had that drilled into me, or a little bit of each. So I feel sometimes that I am just dictating. Like I'm watching this movie happening in my head, and I'm just dictating what's going on. Okay, and then what happened?
Yeah.
Uh-huh, and I'm watching this.
And that experience that you're describing right now is often the one that is most challenging to explain to people who don't work in this way. I have friends who are engineers of one kind or another. Now, some of them have a somewhat creative life in addition to their work, which is engineering this, that, or the other thing. And so it's easier for them to understand. But when I begin describing the creative writing process, they look at me like I'm a guru, and I'm, you know, but seriously, and I don't realize, you know, it was not until I started trying to describe it to them that I understood this language that writers take for granted about seeing it, watching this thing as if you're taking dictation, but that's really how it is.
It's how it is for me. I know. I think that
it's how
everyone's
it is for
process
everybody,
is probably.
Really.
I know everyone's creative process is slightly different, but it's how it is for me, and I can't. I mean, I'm glad that it's that way for me. I don't know that I could change it. I can't not visualize what I'm writing about. It makes sense.
Yeah.
And I'm also very tactile. That I draw out. You were talking about imaginary world building. One of the things I do in my class with the kids. Younger kids, you know, like 9 to 12 years old, is we draw maps as a jumping off point for the storytelling. So I have these maps that I've drawn. They actually ended up going into the second book because I thought, hey, you know, these maps are pretty cool. Maybe these would be good in the book.
Right.
So of the White Forest and of the continent and then of the world. So I can locate myself when I'm When I was writing the second book, I thought, okay, she goes this direction. I'm looking at my map and I'm figuring it out, you know, directionally.
Right.
I've always liked maps too, but that helps me to make the world more real.
Yeah, absolutely.
Imaginary world more real for me.
Hey, I noticed on an interview you did that you mentioned one of the writers you had recently read that inspired you was James DeLint, who Charles DeLint. Charles DeLint, yes, Charles DeLint. And I interviewed him recently. Very nice guy.
Oh, he's lovely.
And he was. And he talked about we were talking about the rules of magic. We got into the rules of magic, how if you have a magical land, he believed, and I feel it's true because I did some writing in the fantasy genre myself, that you've got to have rules to it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so talk to our listeners who maybe are thinking about writing their first fantasy book. Why does magic have to have rules? Why is that so important?
Well, to me, actually, you kind of have to have more rules than you do in a real world scenario to make it more believable, to follow some kind of logical sequence, and also for your own sake to be able to follow. I think it keeps your story believable and logical, and then you can work through the sequence in your head. And I am I'm actually a little bit too anal about it in my work. I thought, can she do this spell? Does she have the power? What do you need to do?
Right.
Does she have the ingredients? You know, I go into it a little bit maybe overzealously. But I'm a huge stickler for when I'm reading a book where someone just like throws a haphazard spell. Here's a spell that happens, and there's no learning behind it or no history behind it, or how did that person so all my magic that happens in the book is very, very carefully thought out. Would she be able to do this yet? And you can kind of watch Brigitte is the main character, the main fairy, and you watch her progression from the first book where she really doesn't know much about, she knows some simple things, you know, like weather spells and how to detect direction, but as the books go, she learns more and more magic, and she becomes more advanced, and you see her becoming more powerful as she learns these things. But haphazard magic, to me, is just sort of like a pet peeve. Like, where did that spell come
from?
Well,
it's really tricky narratively, because what will happen is your readers will do the thing where they'll say, well, why doesn't she just cast that spell? That would end this problem. If there's not a rule to it, then they could say, why did she just disappear? Then the villain won't see her, and there would be no more problem. There has to be a trade-off. There has to be a cost in some way.
There's a cost to magic. There's a cost to use the magic.
That's what James. That's what DeLint said. There's a cost to it. There has to be a cost.
Yeah, and in what was that book, Daughter of Smoke and Bone? What I thought was brilliant about that book was that there was a cost, like the in teeth. I haven't read it in a while, but it was that magic came from teeth, and so that was the cost of it, was to get teeth.
God,
that was so cool. You can use your own or somebody else's. I also read a book where somebody sort of became discovered they were fae, and they became all powerful, and I just thought, well, that's a total cop-out. I mean, they were just all powerful, and suddenly they could just defeat anything, and I thought, well, that's no fun.
Superman. I've never understood how you wrote a story for Superman who couldn't be injured, but they did it again and again and again. But I always thought that was the problem, or the tricky part with him, is that there's nothing he can't do and nothing can stop him unless it's kryptonite.
But then they give him the kryptonite, which is his Achilles heel, right? So you have to give him something. That's the rule. But along the lines of rule, too, are our lineage, like what came before this person, you know, what I look at, what are the hierarchies in this world, and what are the myths of this world? What do they believe? And the more I do that, then I think for me, the more the world becomes believable. But hopefully to the fans too, where there's something else, there's a history behind. I didn't just like pop. We can't just pop into a story. It's not like the world was just created at that moment. There's all this stuff that came before.
Yes.
And that's why I created a world book to go deeper into. After I wrote the first story, I wrote this world book, and that's when I discovered that there were more stories. I wanted to figure out, how did the fairies get to this protected realm where they live? You know, where did all this start? What do they believe? You know, what is the most powerful magic around? I want to answer all these questions for myself.
But I think it's important because one of the things, you know, if I write a book about, I live in Seattle, and if I place a story in Seattle, I don't need to reference everything else going on in Seattle for the contemporary reader to be able to fill in the rest of the modern contemporary American city, right? But if you write a fantasy book, it is very easy for it to exist within the tunnel of the narrative. Like, the rest of that world doesn't exist outside those little events that happen. And somehow, mm-hmm. don't you have to have some way of the reader feeling the largeness of the world beyond the events that happen in the story?
Yes, that's exactly it. And if you're, say you're writing historical fiction and you're writing it in, you know, Vietnam War era, then everyone kind of automatically has that idea of what that's like, and you place it in that town. And even if it's happening in a neighborhood in Ballard in Seattle, there's this right. presence of the Vietnam War around it because that's what was going on during that time, and that feeds it. Well, right. you have to create that for yourself in your world.
Yes,
what is going on? Even if it doesn't even take influence it, if they don't go out into that world, even in that neighborhood of the White Forest, in that village, there's some presence of the larger world. It is on my mind, this larger world.
You know,
seems like a lot to contain.
There is a lot to contain, but there's a certain pleasure in it. Building the world is almost like building a story. Look, because a world is a story. A world is just a story unfolding, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. it has place, but really the world isn't just this lump of rock and grass and trees. It's the narrative of that store, of that world, that you're really mm-hmm. building more than anything else, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. And Brigida, as the story goes, she goes farther and farther out into the world, and because I did the work beforehand, I know what that world looks like. I know who she's going to meet. I know what she's going to find when she gets there. Surprises come to me too. Sometimes I feel like the writing is just leading me places. Like, I didn't know that was going to happen. But since I built this larger world, it makes it easy for me to navigate it now when I need her to go have an adventure in that in that space.
When I was 12 or 13, I was a huge reader of fantasy fiction. It's all I read, and I read a lot of it. I read The Hobbit, and that was it. You know, I was mm-hmm. sold for a number of years. And this wasn't always the case, but every once in a while, I would find myself thinking, boy, I wouldn't mind living there instead of here. Just every once in a while. Not all the time, but sometimes. And I know that's true for a lot of readers of fantasy fiction. Do you ever hear from your fans, who are usually in that 9 to 12 or 13 range, that they would like to go live there, maybe? This place that you've created?
I've never heard that. I've heard they get attached to certain characters. I get lots of pictures of certain characters, which is why there might be an extra book in the series, because the kids like Brigida's little sister, who I just thought, you know, went on the first adventure with her and then that was it.
Right.
But they want more from her, so she might have her own story someday. I can't recall anyone saying they wanted to live in that world. Oh. Although when I'm, I have a performing arts background as well as an educational background. So going on tour is my favorite things to do. So I speak in front of like 200, 300 kids, and I try to put them in this imaginary world. What would it be like to be a fairy and get your destiny markings, and what would those markings look like, and what would they mean, and would you be an earth, air, water, fire fairy? And sometimes when the boys hear about, oh, the book's about fairies, they kind of go, you know. But then when we start getting into the world, they get into it just as much. I have as many boy fans as I do girl fans. It's kind of funny.
It doesn't surprise me.
But they, so I put them in this world, and we do everything from, you know, silly songs and other things. So we have a lot of fun being in that world for, an hour during an assembly.
And so you're going to speak to all these kids. You know, they bring the whole school down, I assume, into the auditorium for this. But most of them, have they all read your book? They probably haven't, yeah?
Most of them haven't, yeah. I mean, it's how I market my book, too. It's like, hey, kids, go talk to your parents.
Yeah. So you're here. You're having to talk to all these kids who haven't read your book. And, you know, they're just there. Oh, it's another adult, blah, 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 blah. So you've got to go and be... So that's how you talk to them, is you try to make it a show in a way?
It's very interactive.
I'm always talking about a challenging experience. Okay.
Pardon?
So what do you do? Well, this is what I always found very challenging is when you go speak to people who haven't read your book, don't know about you, how do you engage them, especially the kids who are just used to being blathered at by adults all the time? Maybe they don't want, you want to engage them in some way.
You get them to, well, especially in that age, 9 to 12, not so much in high school. It's very interesting, the switch that happens. But 9 to 12-year-olds love to share. If you ask them a question about who has a dog, they always say, who has a pet, who has a funny pet story, you know, they all raise their hand, they all want to share. And as a matter of fact, so many kids want to share that they're so sad when they can't.
No.
So I immediately get them into this idea of this protected realm where the fairies live, and they have these destiny markings, and this is what they, what would yours look like? And so I get them interacting with each other, and then I get them doing imaginary world creating kind of things, like they love this. They do animal mashups where they take different animals. So say one had a monkey, one kid, and one had a lion. Then they put them together and they create a monk lion or lion key, and then they figure out what it looked like. Or there's one where they actually make up words and then make up gestures to go with those words. So then we make up like this.
All right.
Dance, so it's like we're doing the Virgil shtick, and then they, you know.
Right.
So I just get them being active, and then I read a portion of the story to them, and then we do, you know, more activities. So it's about engaging them and getting them to share. Once you get them sharing, you really can't stop. That age group, I found with high school students, sometimes.
Yeah, not so much.
Sometimes it's like pulling teeth. So those, I do more workshops with the older kids where they're actually doing some writing. You know, it's they want to do more solitary stuff. Yeah. Getting in the share.
All right. I've got someone on the line who wants to ask you a question here. Okay, so let's
see. Someone's on the line. Wow, I didn't even know they could do that.
Jeff. Hi, this is Guy.
Hi,
Jeff. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for taking my question. I wanted to put a quick plug in for Bill Knauer's fabulous new book, a collection of essays from Author Magazine, Write Within Yourself, an Author's Companion, and it certainly is. Well done, Bill.
Thank you.
Danica, it's wonderful interview, wonderful hearing you. I'm just discovering you. I took on what I thought would be an easy task a couple of years ago when someone asked me to co-write a children's book. Wow. I didn't know what I was getting into.
Just because it's a children's book does not mean it's any easier to write than an adult book.
The most important thing I've ever worked on. What is the secret? What is the key? How do you children? Because you can't dumb down to them. You can't
No.
So
that's a really good point.
Jeff. All right, I'm going to put you on hold, Jeff. We're going to get the... Well, it's a good question. My wife writes children's books, and she gets so irritated when she hears that. Wow, how hard can it be? It's only 5,000 words. Okay, so how do you do it?
Oh, yeah, how hard can it be? Well, you know, kids are very honest. You know, I have focus groups of kids who read my work. That's one thing. If I'm very fortunate, again, that there's this place called Christiane's Lyceum of Literature and Art, and they have book groups, and these kids... I'll send them my manuscript. They will read it, and they will sit there and tell me exactly what they think.
Yes, it's true. They wouldn't think twice about it, would they? About telling you that sucks.
And I love what he said about not dumbing down to them. That is so important. So it's really about finding a balance. The best thing to do is actually, you know, read good books for the age level that you want to write. You can get them, teachers and librarians can recommend them for you, obviously, and to get that voice and not hold back your vocabulary. But again, it's a balance, because sometimes I've read books where I thought, it just doesn't feel like the vocabulary for the audience that you're going for. So it really does take a lot of paying attention. And so reading the age group you want to write in, talking to kids, some of the ideas from the first book literally came from a 9 and 10-year-old girl who I work in the film industry with kids, and I was working in the film industry with them, so I stuck on an idea, and I got one of my ideas from her.
Really?
I stole her idea. No, she was,
well, why
I was
not?
Talking to her. But yeah, it's I wish I could give you the secret magic thing. But really, I think it's a lot of reading and
exposing
it. You
have to love to write for them, I think.
Yes.
You do have to love to write. You have to get them. You really have to get why that age group matters and what it is that's so lovely about them. I think that
And your connection, too, because I think that I really connect with this 9 to 12, 9 to, you know, maybe up to 14 age group, because I remember what I was reading at that time and what I loved, and that's what kind of where I'm focusing my writing, too. But it was that place of the first sort of independence of reading, where you're picking your own books, and it's that coming of age time where you're becoming this individual, and this is what I enjoy reading, not what someone else is giving me to read or my mom bought them from the library. So I love that.
And that's what your characters are going through too. They're starting to blossom and discover themselves at mm-hmm. even your characters are doing that too.
Yeah.
Coming out of the shadow of childhood.
Exactly. Yeah, I really like that step into, and it can be sometimes a dark place. And that I've found, you know, when the world suddenly gets bigger and Brigida or whoever character you're working on discovers the rest of the world, then it's not exactly what they thought it was, and it goes to this darker place. Whereas slightly younger children's literature, like first chapter books, don't go there. Like good and evil is very black and white, you know, very rule oriented, like that. That's something to think about if you're writing first chapter books, which maybe, you know, depends on how precocious the kid is. I have some 6-year-old fans, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, or even maybe 8 years old, where it's, like I said, good and bad is black and white, and they're very rule oriented. Then you get a little bit older, and their gray starts to pop in, where they start to question that someone could do something that for the right reasons, but it's a immoral action. You know, they can't understand that when they're young.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes that age is one of the darkest times for some people, because depending on the circumstances of your life, you might get a glimpse of what human beings are capable of at a time before you are capable of really understanding it, and it can be very dark for a young person confronted with this full reality of death and what human beings can do when in certain situations. So it can be very dark time, very for some kids, and so it's okay to reveal it. And your readers are probably going through it. Some of them are going through it. Some of them are in tough households, you know, or in tough neighborhoods where all kinds of crap's going on, and so
or lots of parents. There's a lot of middle grade books with dead, missing, or divorced parents. Like I see, I blogged about this too, where it seems to be like in order for the kid to go to that dark space and go through that growing that feeling of independence, you have to sort of take away the stability, which is
that's
a parent.
That's right. Absolutely.
So there's a lot of that in middle grade literature.
This certainly is. Well, Danica, what a pleasure. I so love talking to you. Thank you so much for being a part of the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It was my pleasure. Good luck with book 3, which will be coming out in September, October. What's it called? So our audience knows.
Andel of Griath is book 3. I do recommend reading them in order. And it's coming out early November.
Early November. Fairy Tales from the White Forest. Danica, good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And, well, everybody, thank you for tuning in. Next week, I will be talking to Mark Allen, publisher, founder of New World Library, author, lecturer, teacher, musician, all-around good guy. That'll be a good one. Don't want to miss it. Until then, create the world you want to live in. All you got to do is imagine what you want to see and then make it. And lo and behold, you're creating the world you love. What could be better than that? Until then, do what you love, read what you love, write what you love, love who you love. If you do, you'll love it. Bye-bye now.